Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and in my outside studio, I've got Robs. Good morning, Robs.
Morning, Aaron.
Robs is just noticing all the birds. What are you noticing about the birds? What are you learning from the birds right here, Robs?
More curious. There's a lot of chatter with the starlings going to and fro between the town hall and this teacoca tree.
What do you think they're doing to the town hall? With the town hall?
I don't know what they're talking about. That's what excites me. It's not knowing answers is when things get exciting for me.
So what would you normally do if you didn't have an interview right now? Would you sit here and just observe for a while?
I'd be sit and observing and just watch and not really expecting to walk away with my answer.
Right.
But I like having, if you imagine like an answer or a question being an open book, and if you keep that book open, you keep being curious and you know, asking more questions. And as soon as you close that book, you know, you seldom reopen it and it just gets a tick. And I don't like that. I like to have as many books open in my life as I can, because it just makes me all the more curious to navigate the world.
Did you go to university?
I did not go to university.
Probably just as well. They like definite answers out of their students.
Another thing I'm noticing now is you were just saying that these... So we sat just on the east side of the town hall amongst the birch trees, and you were just saying that they got pretty smashed in the storm,
yeah.
The leaves. And it kind of ties a little bit into what I was hoping to talk about, is if they got smashed, then that's because obviously the wind has taken its toll, and the wind didn't come from four directions, it just came from one direction. So knowing which way the winds came from that storm, and you can kind of see by looking at the leaves, you can see which side of the trees got more damage, and therefore, not just these trees, any trees, and therefore you have a compass, an instant compass.
Yeah, I think the ones that these trees got overall damaged mostly, but the ones at our place are very obviously on the west side or the southwest side.
Mm.
Yeah, and that was... I've been here 20 years, I haven't seen a storm do that to the trees before.
Really?
It's really, I presume it's salt.
Uh-huh.
Is the issue, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, I heard a friend say, and he lives probably like 5 km inland, and he had to hose his house down from all the salt.
Yeah, well, I still haven't cleaned the upper windows at the studio from it yet. I've got the lower ones. We can reach them. Tell the listeners what you'd like to talk about today. Or I don't know if I've introduced Rob's properly. This is our Nature Connection segment. And Rob's runs... Are you still calling it Kura Taiao Nature School?
Yeah, still call it Kura Taiao.
Okay. And you've been working on a Nature Connection website for a while.
For years and years and years.
Tell me how that's going?
No, I don't want to tell you how that's going. I don't want to talk about that.
You've been outside.
Yeah, it's tricky finding the time. And, you know, with work and family life.
Yeah.
The moments I do get, I do like to make the most of and spend doing the things I love. So those jobs, which are not my favourite ones, tend to hit the back burner for a while.
And normally I would say it's been a great summer for being outside, but you probably would have been anyway a lot of the time, I imagine.
I try to, although I'm very excited about the turning of the seasons, because I tend to spend more outdoor time and, you know, more immersed bush time in the winter months.
Okay.
That's my favourite. So I was actually out this weekend, I was out on Saturday night, and loving these cold nights, loving the challenge of the cold nights. I learned so much. It's easy in summertime, because you can basically just lie down somewhere and it's warm enough to be comfortable.
You'd probably be too hot, and even in the bush this summer.
Yeah.
So what was the main topic of conversation or our Kickstarter today?
I've been really passionate about developing my natural navigation knowledge.
Okay.
Which is, I guess, you know, the times before we had compasses and the signs around us, you know, the trees. Obviously the sun's an obvious one, moon, stars.
Yeah.
Plants, animals. There's so many little indicators which can help us find the directions.
So how did you develop these skills? Was this another one of these go and try it things that you've done?
Same with most things in Nature Connection. It's really just through observation and looking closely. And, you know, we know that plants are really, their growth is really influenced dominated by wind and sun.
Yeah.
They're looking for light and they're protecting from the wind. And with that in mind, you know, most plants you can look at and look at the way they grow and the pattern they've grown and the shape they've taken, and that can give you clues to where north might be, where the sun might be strongest, where the prevailing winds might be coming from. Algae on plants, sometimes mosses. Everything's a clue because everything has a reason behind it. Like, nothing in nature's really random.
Even if you're in fairly dense bush where the trees are all sheltering each other?
That's, of all, there's a guy who sort of made a living and is really good at what he does called Tristan Gooley. He's an English guy from Cornwall, I think. And, you know, he's written books and, yeah, goes around the world basically teaching people, sometimes, you know, the military, sometimes just, you know, passionate outdoors people.
Yeah.
And navigating the bush, especially when it's sort of up and down, is definitely head and shoulders the most difficult terrain to practice natural navigation.
Yeah.
And lucky for me, that's pretty much 100% of the environment that I practice natural navigation, so I'm in at the deep end.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like a challenge.
Well, in the modern world, those are the bits of the land that haven't been used for farming, so I guess inevitably, if you're going to get lost in the bush, it's going to be like that, at least in this country.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, do you think you could get lost if someone...
Yeah, totally.
...you and put you, left you and you woke up in the bush, you had no idea where you were, would you be able to find your way out?
Yeah, I think I could find my way out. I actually sort of have dreams of doing that. Like, one day I want someone, maybe not to drug me and dump me, but maybe, like, blindfold me and helicopter me or something.
Yeah.
I'd love that. That would be, you know, that'd be a dream come true for me to practice that.
I guess most people would, if you had your head about you, would say, well, if I follow a waterway, then that's going to stop me going around in circles.
Yeah. But the going around in circles thing's interesting, and it's a thing I get when I'm running workshops.
Is it a true common thing, or is that to a do? Mythology?
No, it's a true thing. If I took you to the rugby ground right now and blindfolded you,
yeah,
and got you to walk from one goal to the other one, you wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't get there.
You might not even hit the halfway line before you've gone off the side of the pitch.
Right.
And that is true for apparently every human being. Like. And Tom Brown Jr., who I guess, you know, is quite a way further down the path than I am, but he runs Tracker School in the States.
Yeah.
And he adamantly states that no human that has ever existed has a true sense of direction, and that's the proof of it. And blindfold you, no one can walk in a straight line. And you're 10 to 1 direction. You might go right, you might go left, but that'll be your direction. You know, every time you walk, you'll tend to that direction.
Yeah.
And there's theories behind it. I think for me, you know, no body's like symmetrical.
You were not machines.
Really? You know, you're right-handed, you can have more muscle mass on your right side, and over a distance, that's probably going to influence, you know. Most people have one leg slightly longer than the other, that's another thing.
It wouldn't take much. You don't need much to eventually end up off course.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But over, you know, over a big distance, that's a big difference that you're going.
So as well as the obvious of going with waterways, what else do you do if you find yourself...
Well,
what else would you,
as I say, I've been dreaming of this. So the first thing I would do, you know, given that I might be anywhere in New Zealand, is I'd just sit and I'd watch the sky, and the first thing I'd look out for is aeroplanes.
Yeah.
And I'd spend a day watching aeroplanes, and given the frequency and the direction, you know, the most of them are going to be going at Christchurch, Auckland, Wellington.
Yeah.
So you look at the sky here, you know... For a day, you're going to know where Auckland is, and you're going to know where North is from the aeroplanes.
Yeah.
The dream is someone's going to drop me in the wilderness in the South Island, in which case I'd probably gauge where Christchurch was, and that would probably give me a decent... If there was a map of the South Island, I could probably more or less put my finger on whereabouts I might be relative to Christchurch.
There might be some areas around Fiordland where you might be a bit stuck.
Yeah, it's true. That not much air traffic there.
You'd know you were there though, because it'd be a lot colder.
Yeah, and
overnight,
potentially the only part of New Zealand which wouldn't have air traffic.
Yeah.
So if there was nothing,
or might have tourist that might planes. Be might have tourist flights.
Yep.
But they might not help you at all. They'd be going round.
Well, it would if it says Fiordland Airlines. Which I might, you know, see if they're probably going low enough to see.
Yeah.
Which brings me to, I actually brought my bush bag with me today, which has got a few of the pieces of gear that I take in with me to the bush, which I was going to talk a little bit about.
Okay.
And first one of them is a camera. And you can get these pocket super zoom cameras, and it's in place of a telescope or binoculars.
Oh, yeah.
You can get, you know, I mean, this isn't the one, but one that size, you can get up to 40 times zoom, which is amazing, you know, with high definition video, and, you know, they're quite inexpensive, and it fits in your pocket.
So this is just a normal little camera. Oh, people don't really buy them much anymore.
No.
We use our cell phone, but it's got a zoom, and, yeah.
And this is, it's great for documenting things, you know, sometimes, yeah, I might see a beautiful bird, and it's nice to film it in close up, and then you can really look close and, you know, explore and learn about its behavior. Sometimes I might see a plant doing something weird or anything, and I'll take a picture and I'll try and decipher it at home. It's just I use it all the time, or, you know, a tree which you're not familiar with, but the leaves are up way up high, so you can zoom in and get a nice close-up of the leaves and get to know things.
If you're
like
lost,
that.
Are you still doing this?
Lost is an interesting thing, because it's the mentality, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, if you're feeling lost, you're probably not going to be doing something.
Yeah, like that. I mean, and anyone will tell you when you're lost, first thing to do is calm yourself down.
Yeah.
And try and get out of that lost mentality and the panic that it brings. I'm very rarely in the bush feeling that panic. I mean, I guess yesterday I sort of had to try and get out in time to be back to the family.
Yeah.
And you know, I wasn't using any tracks or compasses, and I needed to find water, and yeah, it took me a bit longer than I thought. So I guess there was a sense of it yesterday. There's a sense of like, I need to like push on and figure out how to get out of here quickly.
Feeling of pressure to get it done.
But yeah, I mean, lost is only when you, there's a time and a place, and there's somewhere else that you feel you need to be.
Yeah.
But when I'm in the bush, I'm in my happy place. And I guess when you've got the skill set as well, that, you know, I can be warm and I can probably find enough food, and I know there's water.
Yeah.
And I could probably be here for months and I'd have the best time of my life.
Right.
You know, that makes it a really different experience from being lost and not knowing, you know, being really unfamiliar with where you're at. Man, I'm going to starve because I don't know what to eat, and I might eat something poisonous, and it's going to be so cold at night, and I don't know how to keep myself warm. Worlds apart, that experience. Yeah.
So what else have you got in your...
In my bag, I have got a trusty knife. This is a Finnish knife. I won't bore you with the details of it.
But pull it out of the sheath.
It is one, which is full tang, which means the metal body of the knife goes right through thick, which means it's basically unbreakable.
It goes through the handle.
If you've got a tool...
They haven't tried to save a bit of money by shortening the
it's a good, solid, quite thick
steel knife. That is quite a solid blade.
And you can do many things with this, but knife,
so it's not just for cutting up steak.
It's mostly preparing for a fire.
The blade, I could see it could handle a lot more than like kitchen knives would.
So I could split wood with this. I could make a bow out of a stick just using this knife. But I can do fine things. I can get really fine shavings for making tinder for my fire, but tinder bundles and for fire lighting.
And you keep it nice and sharp, no doubt.
So if I can find it, I've got a little knife sharpener, tiny pocket knife sharpener, because a sharp knife is a good knife. If a knife isn't so sharp, it actually becomes more of a dangerous tool.
So it's not a stone?
It's a little diamond. I don't know what the main metal is, but it's got little grits of diamond on it, really fine ones.
Oh, wow. Does that cost much?
Nah, 30 bucks.
When you say diamond, I immediately think, oh, it's
going to be... Nah, I think it's just like diamond dust.
Right.
But yeah, 30 bucks or something.
Okay.
If your knife's not very sharp, it doesn't always do what you want it to do, and then it can become quite dangerous. So keeping your blade sharp is pretty important. The next one is maybe my favourite, and possibly the top of the list, the one piece of gear which I don't want to go into the bush without, and it's a $2 inflatable pillow. I can.
So you don't sleep with your head on a log, then, Rob?
Well, you know, I have done many times, but I my neck and back upper muscles tend to be very tight a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm very prone to injuries around there.
Right.
And you know, I'd pick this above a sleeping bag. I'd take this in instead of my knife. This would be my, just, I don't know, it just makes all the difference to just have that. That's very much a personal thing.
Yeah, but I can understand
many
that.
Of you will find comfort without that, but for me, it seems important for me to bring that in.
You don't want to wake up with a migraine. That's not going to get you anywhere.
Or a crooked neck.
Yeah.
Another piece, probably bottom of the list, but a nice piece anyway, is a little folding saw.
Oh, yes.
Which, It speeds a few jobs up, a few sort of bushcraft jobs.
So what sort
up.
Of things are you cutting with that?
I'll cut notches into my fireboard when I'm doing friction fire. It just speeds things up. Can totally do it without a saw. You can actually split wood with a saw in quite a quick way. If you cut it halfway and then bang it on something hard, then that half log just pops off.
Okay.
And just, fine cut. Sometimes, you know, I'll sit around and do a bit of crafting, whittle something.
It's what you do when you haven't got the internet.
Yeah.
Whittling.
Sit around watching birds and whittling. And that is mostly it. I did bring
really?
In. I did
That's
bring
what,
in.
Four things?
Well, I did bring. Sometimes I bring a water bottle. I mean, often I don't, you know, sometimes I don't even bring a knife. Yesterday, this weekend, I didn't take any water.
It would be make very lightweight travel.
But a water bottle in winter, especially is one which has got a good stainless steel body with nothing else, just pure steel, you can put on a fire. So this, I can cook meals in it.
That
I can purify water in it. And a good little trick that I do is before I go to bed, if I'm not tending a fire through the night, is I'll fill it with water, bring it to the boil, pop the lid on, wrap it in a t-shirt, and it's a hot water bottle, and it'll still be warm in the morning.
Is that right?
So,
is that a twin wall bottle, that one?
No, I have twin wall ones, because between the layers is usually, you know, an insulation material stuff.
Yeah,
which you wouldn't want to mount, so this is just a single wall.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But even wrapped up, it does still stay warm. So, lots of functions for a water bottle.
Must admit, I thought you said you'd bring it for summer. Like, I thought it might be harder to get water in summer.
No, there's always a cool thing about New Zealand. Is, I mean, if you look at any map, you'll see waterways anywhere. Like,
yeah.
And I was in the bush, I guess, sort of north of the Divi, that divide between, you know, main Waikato and this western side. And, yes, there's streams all over. Every valley has pure spring water coming out of it, even now.
I guess it's just the farms that struggle with the drought.
Yeah. I think further down. But and I've never had any problems. I don't wanna like say everyone go drink out of streams and you'll be fine. But for me, when it's just a bush stream and I know it's just come from a spring out of the bush and it hasn't gone through any farmland and I know they haven't dropped poison in that area recently. I've never had any problems.
That could be a challenge for your hypothetical drop Rob in the bush and let him find his way out. Maybe you'd probably want, if you're going to actually do that experiment, you'd actually want to know that 1080 hadn't been dropped recently.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's a...
Yeah, sometimes the man-made dangers are the hardest ones to figure out.
So if you... So let's say you're down, go back to that thing, if you're in the bush, you don't know exactly where, somewhere in the South Island, you've seen the planes flying, you think to Christchurch, what do you do then, walk to Christchurch?
Sometimes the way which seems the shortest isn't necessarily the easiest, and you know, time-wise isn't going to be the quickest. So figuring out, mapping your terrain, I guess, you know.
Do you go up to do that?
You don't have to. You just, mountain ranges generally, you know, the ridge of them generally follow a line. I think that's true of pretty much all the mountain ranges in New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, mostly following the fault lines here.
Yeah.
And generally, give or take a few degrees, they're quite often a north-south. You know, if you go to the Southern Alps, going right down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Tararua ranges, the Kaimais. It all helps that sort of no self aspect.
Yeah.
Which means eventually streams are usually going to run east-west when they become rivers. You know, there'll be sub-bridges and, you know, when the springs come out, that's not going to be true. But if you follow them for a while, they should generally follow a loose east-west. So just sort of mapping out the terrain as if you're looking down on it. That can give you some clues. You know, if you're up on the ridge, it can give you a really straight line for quite a while. They usually, you know, they don't often curve around the ridges, only when they meet the dominant ridge at the top. So figuring that out, and then I guess, you know, figuring the ease of it, making it easy. You know, there might be a way out which is just steep and dense and, you know, potentially dangerous. You don't want to hurt yourself. Well, there might be a longer way around, but it's just a nice stroll. You know, if you haven't got that pressure of time and you know that you can keep yourself warm and you'll have water, enjoy a nice stroll.
The if you're far enough south, I know the bush is less dense. Well, my very small knowledge about it is you can just walk through the trees
different.
And you can see
it's
a bit
island.
Further.
Yeah,
that's colder, of course, too. If you're down there. But my idea I initially said at the start, you know, people might automatically think, well, if I follow a stream, at least I won't be going in circles. But is that necessarily a good idea in New Zealand? Sometimes gullies are, like, pretty gnarly.
Follow it with your ears is my advice. If you're walking alongside a stream, that's, you know, there's water, it's moist, it's perfect growing conditions, and so it's generally really, really thick. Especially with, you know, things like supplejack vines, which will really slow you down. It's like a web you gotta get through, and it's tricky. And again, you get frustrated, and then you get complacent, and there's more chance of hurting yourself. But if you are sort of mid-ridge, which is often where a lot of the mammals in the bush like to travel, if they go on long distances, they'll be up on the ridge. But most of the times, I'm seeing them hang out. They're chilling out and resting mid-ridge, sometimes where there's a clearing. So there's usually tracks which are following the streams. Goat, deer tracks.
Are they very obvious tracks? To you, maybe?
To me, they are. I'm thinking back 5 years ago. Maybe they wouldn't be obvious. But I don't think it would take you long to know and feel it, especially if you get down at their level. If you get down on your hands and knees, they become a lot more obvious.
Well, we're really familiar with a farm, on the hillside of a farm, how tracks form and steps and things like that. Is there an element of that?
Yeah, there's compression on the leaves, so you can definitely see, you know, there's been steps taken on there. You can follow that, and they're awesome. That's all I was using this weekend. And
so where were you this weekend?
I walked into the bush at the end of Cogswell Road, which is the last on the left before the divvy.
Yeah,
right at the end there, near a lodge, and I walked right over the range to the stream. There's a nice reserve at Karakariki.
Yeah.
So the stream which feeds that, but near the source of the stream is where I camped for the night. And the goats, they know their way around more than anyone.
Yeah.
All the mammals, you know, the deer as well.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll turn off, and I'll seemingly be going in completely the wrong direction and be going, oh, hang on a minute. And then they'll turn back around, and I've realised I've just avoided a really difficult, dense, you know, troublesome, dangerous bit of terrain.
Nature finds a way.
Yeah, they know the easiest ways around. They're really efficient. Always hearing that stream, especially if you do something called deer ears, it will increase your ability to hear water.
Am I putting my hand up by my ears?
So you just like cut behind your ears, and you get a whole heap of different frequencies.
Yeah,
and I reckon it adds about 100 meters to your ability to hear a stream.
Yeah,
so that's
and
a real handy
kind of high pitched tinkling sounds. They stand out
through
our ears.
Yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah. What about if you're getting near the edge of the forest, do you start to see species that don't normally hang around out in the bush, or is that really on the edge? You don't see that.
Yeah, it's like plant species, totally.
Okay, I was thinking of birds and animals, but yeah. Plant species. More
no,
likely.
Plant species. I mean, you get, you know, things like blackbirds. I've found quite deep in the bush. They're ground feeders, and they're often scratching around on the leaf litter on the floor.
But not all the way in. Not forever.
I've seen them deep in the Uruwera, far from places.
Right.
So I think
not really
there. You know, there's a lot of seed and berries and insects for them to live a pretty healthy life there, I think. But more plant species. So when I was getting onto the edge of the bush yesterday, I started to see Himalayan honeysuckle.
Yeah.
And you know, gorse. Always gorse on the ridges.
On the ridges, did you say?
Yeah, on the ridges where there's a slight clearing.
Yeah.
Usually goats like the place that gorse likes is the places that goats seem to like.
Okay.
So if you ever like hanging out with goats like me, that's a place that I might hunt out. Yeah, and I mean, if you're getting right on the edge of the bush, there's definitely a huge change in native fauna. You get your trees, you know, more of your podocarps, which like to live in the heart of the bush, and then you get your other species, which are more on the edge.
But if we're not very experienced at the bush, we probably won't pick a lot of that up.
But
I can't visualise a podocarp, for instance.
You can't, but if... You know, if you're in the bush, just using logic, you could probably pick it. If I showed you a few pictures and said which of these trees is in deep in the middle of the bush and which is on the edge, just from the shape of them and how they grow, you'd probably figure it out.
And you would, if you've been observant and you're not panicking, you would notice the change in the vegetation.
Yeah. And again, you know, going higher up, things change as well. Trees get a lot smaller and you get some different species higher up.
Yeah.
But trees are possibly what I use most or most excited about using as a compass for natural navigation. Again, the sun's easy. A day like today, you know, I know the sun's probably about... I know the sun rose at 7:30 about that this morning, and it's going to set about 7:30 at night, which means about 1:30 this afternoon is when it's like midday, solar midday,
and
in the midpoint.
Right here.
We've just passed equinox.
So it must be rising pretty much due east.
Yeah, just slightly north of east, but only a few degrees. So you can work out it's going to be 0 degrees at 1:30. It rose at 7:30, so we're about 2 hours from sunrise.
Is the sun low enough now to see what direction it is? Like, at the height of summer, I look up and I'm like, it's just above me.
It is above you, but if you did put a stick, there will be a slight, unless you're on the equator, there's going to be a slight, which is enough.
Yeah, well, we need the
enough
equator.
Enough to give you the sign. But 2 hours, if you divide, 90 by 7, so it's like 7:30 in the morning till 1:30, is that 7 hours?
You asked me to do maths.
No, that's 6 hours. So if you divide your 90 degree, which is your east to north, divide that by 6. It's hard doing maths on the radio.
Yeah.
Because you know that. But I think we're about 15 degrees an hour.
Yeah.
So what we're 2 hours, so 30 degrees. So I know that coming up to 10, that is going to be about 60 degrees sun now. So that's a really accurate compass.
Yep.
And obviously, you know, you're going to need a watch on your arm to use that, and I never have a watch. But as an example,
yes,
that's using the sun. But I like to use trees, and in the bush it's tricky because, you know, most trees, they're competing for light, not for sunshine. So they grow in all sorts of different directions. You know, a lot of them are on a slope, so the slope's going to influence them, the wind's going to influence them. But some species, Reiwere was really good. Totara is probably one of the best I've found. If you get up on the ridge and you find these trees, they'll have heavier growth on the north side.
Okay.
They call it the tick effect, which is on the north side, the branches grow a lot more closer horizontal because they're kind of stretching out.
Yeah.
That's where the sun is. but on the south side they need to reach up so that they're growing more vertically. So if you sort of did a line with your finger, it looks like a tick.
Right.
So using the tick effect on trees can give you a good compass.
There we go.
Some people talk about using moss, but I discourage that because moss isn't necessarily shade, it's moisture. So it can guide you to water, but it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, that's the south side. If you know, sometimes it's the opposite.
Right. Rob, we've it's time to wrap up.
Okay.
I think we're no longer lost in the bush, though, so that's good. We can find our way out. Thank you for coming in this morning.
It's and a pleasure.
Next time we will be back in the studio.
That's a shame.
That's a shame. Well, we could do it outside if you really want. Because in actual fact, it'll be an hour later, won't it? Because daylight saving will finish. It'll actually be a bit warmer.
Yep. So. But I can see it's a bit of a technical nightmare sometimes. A lot of fiddling around, so I wouldn't wish that upon you.
I've enjoyed doing it. Like, I've enjoyed the fact that I was forced to do something different through the red setting. So,
yeah.
But there are times, like, obviously I can't do it when it's raining.
True.
And we're lucky today is a beautiful morning.
Yeah, after the anyone.
Sun's out, birds are tweeting. Birds probably tweet in the rain, though, so you tell me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
All right, folks, we've been talking to Robs from Nature Connection. If you want to catch the podcast, go to raglanradio.com or the new website address, raglancommunityradio.nz, and I upload the podcast after the show, and they usually pop up on the website a couple of hours later. But thanks for coming in, Rob. See you in a few weeks.
Always a pleasure, Aaron. Thank you.